Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Chapter 18 of Luke opens, "Then Jesus told them a parable about their need to pray always and not lose heart." We don't often do this here at the table, but I want to suggest this is your moment to take out a pen and get ready to take some notes, because who in the world does not need a lesson on praying always and not losing heart? So I'll give you a second. Here's what Jesus says. "In a certain city, there was a judge who neither feared God nor had respect for people. And in that city, there was a widow who kept coming to him and saying, 'Grant me justice against my opponent.' For a while, he refused, but later he said to himself, 'Though I have no fear of God and no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice so that she may not wear me out by continually coming.'" That's your instruction for how to pray always and how to not lose heart. All right, should we wrap it up? Initially, my image, we have Evelyn. We have four generations that come at our 9:30 service in a family, and Evelyn is the great-grandmother, and she uses a walker. So my image is like a person who's quite feeble in one of the walkers that kind of folds down, coming to the judge, kind of like Golden Girls feel to this space, and like waving a finger, "Listen to me, young man." And what we hear the judge say is, "I will grant her justice so that she may not wear me out by continually coming." That's what the New Revised Standard Version, that's how it translates the original Greek. And what I want to invite you into is the original translation has a little different feel to it, okay? So instead of "that she may not come wear me out by continually coming," it's "I will grant her justice so that she may not hit me under the eye or give me a black eye by continually coming." Now, that is not the same feeble grandma who had the walker. This is like MMA-trained grandma who is coming to go to the mat with this person, ready or not, right? Like, this is the grandma who, back in the day when girls couldn't wrestle, she was on the wrestling team anyways, and right now she is ready to show you that she still remembers exactly how to move in this way. This is the story that Jesus shares about how you're to pray always and not lose heart. So I want to wonder with you for a moment about, are we to be persistent like this widow, and the judge then is God, and we're to plead to God for justice? Like, are we to put ourselves in that place? And what does that do? Like, will God then eventually relent because God thinks we're going to like punch God in the eye over and over, and like God finally is like, "I give up"? Like, that's kind of a weird concept of God if we put it in that way. And dominant expressions of Christianity have often read this parable in this way. And on a certain level, it means we're like going fisticuffs with God, right? And so the Enneagram 8 challengers in the room, they're like, "Yeah, finally somebody's teaching us how to pray. Like, this is awesome. We're going to like get into it with God." But the rest of us in the sanctuary are unsettled. At least I am. I hope you are. By what are we to do with this? Like, what is this concerning image about this widow who's going to hit this judge in the eye? And what are we going to do about this? So I want to just invite you to bracket that story, okay? We're going to come back to it. We're not going to leave the widow and the judge there. We'll return to where they are. But I want to share with you another, maybe even more prominent Fight Club scene. This isn't the only place where God and humanity are having it out. The other reading that Pastor Penny shared with us is found in Genesis 32. So to set it up, there's a pastor, her name is Callie Plunkett Bruton, and she writes this about the short story from Genesis 32. This is a profoundly mysterious story with numerous unanswerable questions. Its storyline, a lone human being wrestles through the night with a nameless antagonist and emerges from the night transformed, is one that's repeated so often in human experience that the reader scarcely realizes that this is an ancient story, because it involves the theme of human transformation. It is a familiar and compelling narrative to people of all times. You see versions of this story over and over and over. Biblical scholars argue that you cannot understand the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament if you do not understand the story of Jacob wrestling through the night right here. You cannot understand the Hebrew Bible and Old Testament without that. And so by extension, followers of Jesus cannot really understand Christianity without grappling, did you like that pun? Without grappling with this particular story as well. So in short, this story reminds us that the relationship between God and God's people is a wrestling match. And while the Jewish faith into which Jesus was born and lived and moved and had his being makes a lot of space for that kind of wrestling with God, contemporary Christianity has not followed suit. We haven't given a lot of space for this kind of interaction or engagement or wrestling with God. Jacob's story can be a troubling one then for contemporary Christians, as troubling really as the parable from Luke chapter 18. See, Jacob is no obvious role model. And for to bring us up to who this Jacob character is, he was actually born seven chapters prior to the story that we heard this morning. And he is a twin. His twin is Esau. And from the literal first moment of his birth, he is wrestling with the world, with his family. And then he moves from that wrestling to con and to cheat and to deceive and to manipulate every member of his family. And then as all of those tensions and struggles are starting to get to a boiling point, right before that happens, he flees. Okay? That's the character that we're talking about here. Okay? So at this moment, we're now 20 years have passed, and he's getting ready to return to his homeland. And so you can imagine the feelings that would be going on if you had deceived and hurt and wounded all of your family members 20 years ago and then left. You can imagine it would be a fairly anxiety-producing experience to journey back toward them. He's fairly convinced that Esau is going to meet him with wrath. That's what's going on in his heart, where he's feeling he's moving to. And what we learn in this story is that Jacob divides his family, two wives, two servants, 11 children. We're going to bracket that too. We're not going to come back to that today. That is another story, okay? Two wives, two servants, all these other things. We'll come back to that at a different moment. If you want to ask or you have questions about that, I'd be happy to talk more afterwards. That's a different sermon. He puts them into two camps and crosses the river with them, and then he leaves them alone, leaves them there. And Dr. Amy Merrill Willis has helped me to reflect on the fullness and the breadth of Jacob's story as we try to hold this week. And what she reminded me of in part was that Jacob is rarely alone. And so any twin can tell you what that experience is like. But Jacob as a twin has rarely been alone in his life. In fact, the last time that Jacob spent time alone in Scripture, he was in another town. He had just barely escaped his brother Esau, and he felt like the threat of Esau was behind him. He had gotten away from that. And at that moment, God visits Jacob in the night and promises blessings to come, land and children and protection. And on Jacob's return home now, 20 years later, God takes advantage of another moment of Jacob being in solitude on his own. A moment that Jacob is exposed. You can imagine he's put his family there. It's nighttime. He's come back across the river. He's vulnerable. And it's in that space that God chooses to reveal God's self to Jacob. But this time, not as a protector. This time, God shows up disguised as threat. And Genesis 32 is really cryptic, like oftentimes in stories in Scripture are. But it just says that a man wrestled with Jacob until the break of dawn. A man wrestled with Jacob until the break of dawn. So there's several things for us to notice or to wonder about in this story. And the first is the timing in which it happens. So like so often is the case that transformation happens, it's at that moment that's between the darkness of night and the dawn of the morning. It's that in-between liminal space that transformation happens within our hearts and our minds. And this is true not just in Scripture, but in many, many stories and how we construct these. Notice also that the passage does not reveal the man's identity. It's just a man wrestled with Jacob until the break of dawn. And biblical scholars have suggested a number of different reasons around this. Like, who is this man through the centuries that Jacob is wrestling with? Some have argued that this man is his brother, like Esau. This is coming back to meet him in that moment. Others have argued that this is Jacob wrestling with his own inner demons in the midst of the nighttime. However we understand who or what Jacob is wrestling with there, what we find in verse 32 is that Jacob identifies the stranger, this man, as none other than God. So that's what comes to be, but we don't know that through the entirety of the story. And then we're left to ask, like, why is God playing the part now of antagonist? Like, why is God showing up as this hostile, it seems to me, wrestler in the night? And whatever the reasons are for the attack, this time Jacob does not run. He goes to the mat with this threatening form himself. Dr. Amy Merrill Willis notes that in some ways, this is not a new response, for Jacob was a wrestler even before his birth. He was a wrestler in the womb with what would be his older brother. And just the name Jacob in the Hebrew, you can see how closely it is here, tied and connected to the word wrestling. So there's a play that's going on in this as well, with language and with names and with words. Jacob wasn't able to wrestle with God 20 years ago, but this night on the river, he does. And in some ways, this is a departure from how he has shown up with others over the last 20 years. Jacob has not been able to deal with things directly over these 20 years. He's done everything slant in conniving ways as he's moved around. He's cheated and stolen. That's how he's moved. And at this moment, he fights openly and persistently, holds on to this threat, this being what we come to know as God, and won't let go until he receives a blessing. And then, if we might think that that blessing is just for like the individual, what happens right afterwards in the next chapter is that Jacob encounters his twin, Esau, the one that he assumed was going to come with wrath to get him back for all the harm that he had caused. And instead, what Jacob says is this: "For truly to see your face," he's talking to his brother, "is like seeing the face of God, since you have received me with such favor." So what we find in this moment is that Jacob's wrestling with the divine shapes and prepares him to actually go back to his brother that he has seen as enemy and to look into his eyes and to see a brother. So this hasn't just shaped his relationship with God, but with his family and his neighbors. And God does not punish Jacob's conflicted character, but instead challenges it and reshapes it, so that Jacob is able to live into his promised destiny as Israel, which according to Genesis, this chapter 20, in verse 29, it says, what this means is one who strives with God and with humans. That's our task, is to strive to wrestle with God and humans. Again, Dr. Amy Merrill Willis says, Jacob's story is a much needed reminder that in the life of faith, there is no one model to which we must conform and submit. God entertains all kinds of characters and personalities, even those who appear to be unconventional or irreverent by our standards. Thankfully. So how might you be called, how might we be called to wrestle with God right now? I think that question is actually at the heart of what we call our deep commitments here at the table. And we return to these each year as a community to wrestle with God and with one another about how we want to share our life together, how we want to root our lives in grace and to grow in faith and reach in love and give generously. And it is an invitation to wrestle with those questions. And I want to share a little bit. Actually, there were five of us who were invited to be part of a group that met all day on Friday and then gathered as well on Saturday. Five of us were at the table, and then a few young people from the table joined us. We were coming alongside 30 United Methodist churches from throughout Northern California and Nevada. And the invitation that this group has taken on is to try to reflect together over a year about how might we be more welcoming and hospitable and inclusive for younger generations. And so the table was asked to come along this process, one, to think about for ourselves, what could that look like here for us? And then also for a number of churches who have really struggled with this, to be a coaching congregation as well, to help people think about their own stories and to share some of our stories as we've evolved and grown and shifted here. So some of the things that we wrestled with God and humans about yesterday and on Friday. First, we wondered about just our hospitality teams, about how might the experience of somebody who has had trauma in their own life around religious community find this place a more welcoming place as they get off their bike or they walk or they get out of their car to come into this space. And what could it look like for this to be a more welcoming place as folks make their way? We shared a dream with each other about how we might use the formation that we have in what we call our kitchen tables, where we gather to watch over each other in love. We wondered about what might it be like for junior high and senior high youth to start to move into their own versions of kitchen tables, where there might be a similar number of junior high students or high school students coming alongside adults to watch over each other in love and learning how to share leadership. We wondered what that could look like, and we're dreaming about a Growing in Faith series that would be specifically for teens and adults together, that would be led by a teenager and an adult as we do that. We didn't just wonder about the young people that are already among us. We also reflected on the challenges and the hopes of so many young people here in Sacramento who slept last night on somebody else's couch or outside because their home is no longer a safe place for them to be because of the way that they're starting to express their gender, the truth that they're coming to know of their own sexuality. And we wondered about what could our call be in the midst of those hurts that are real right in our midst. In short, we spent 2 days wrestling with God and humans. And I actually left, especially Saturday morning, I was like just emotionally drained from that process of living in those questions. So it's not a coincidence that the worship series that we do each year that has the lowest number of people that come to it is our series on deep commitments. It turns out when you invite people to wrestle with God, people are like, I don't know, Apple Hill? there's a lot of options out there, so y'all are amazing. Or you didn't know what series we were in. So in short, though, we're wrestling with that. And this morning, what we want to invite you to do is to begin or continue your own wrestling with where God might be calling you right now. To wonder a little bit about what it might look like in your life to cling to God in the way that Jacob did in the middle of the night. And refuse to let go until you hear the blessing that God has for you. We call that rooting our lives in grace. That's what we mean by it. And Jacob exemplifies that in the middle of the night. And I wonder what that could look like for you in the days and weeks and the year ahead. See, Jacob chose to fight openly that night with the one that he would come to know as God. And to do that, he had to let go of, or as we sang in Hard Love, he had to die to some of the ways that he had learned how to be in the world. He had learned to get by through stealing, through deceit. And he had to die to that, to stand face to face with God, to face his greatest fears, his demons. the way we think about that here at the table is growing in faith. Like, what kinds of things are we in a process of dying to so that we can grow in our own trust and faith in God's movement in our lives? Jacob left that moment. In my image, anyways, Jacob limped from there on out. He limped because his hip had been disjointed by God in that moment. And he does the unthinkable as he's both wounded and blessed by God. He does the unthinkable, which is to look into the eye of his brother. And instead of seeing an enemy, he sees a friend. He sees a sibling. He sees a brother. And so it leads me to wonder about in my life and in your life, what would it look like to wrestle with God and to take the wounds of that and the blessing of that in ways that it might allow us or shape us to reach in love and to live more generously? See, the personal reckoning that Jacob engaged through the night had communal consequences. It wasn't just about him. It was about how he saw the people in his own life. And so how might our personal reckonings with our fears, our inner demons, lead us to new ways of reaching in love? See, it's out of this powerful images of wrestling with God and humanity that I want to invite us now to return back to that parable from chapter 18 of Luke, to rehear maybe where that parable is going. The parable of the widow and the judge. And I open by sharing some of the ways dominant strands of Christianity have tended to interpret the judge as God and the widow as humanity. And our task is to be like her and to be persistent in going to God with our hopes and to sharing that. And I want to invite you to just turn that upside down. And Steve Garnes Holmes talks about it this way. He says, our gender and power stereotypes tell us to assume the judge is God, which would make us the poor widow. But wait, who judges? Who cares neither for God or people? That would be us. And who continually demands that we do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God? That would be God. Sorry, he says, we don't get the high ground here. Denying our privilege, pretending we're faithfully imploring God with our persistent quest for justice, we're the ones deaf to the cries of the poor. God comes in the voice of the vulnerable, the easily ignored, while we in our arrogance easily ignore. How disconcerting that in this story, the ball is in our court, not God's. The demand has been made over and over and over and over. Jesus warns us, God can outlast us. But when God comes, will God find us listening? See, Luke's Jesus ultimately compares God to a judge, but says that God is in fact not like this reluctantly responsive judge. If anything, God is more like the widow in her own relentless commitment to justice. So how will we respond to the God who comes to us as a relentless grandma imploring us to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with God? Instead of waiting quietly for the year ahead, our invitation, I think, is to wonder about how we might resist evil and injustice in whatever forms they appear right now, hearing that call from this widow God. And this is the question that we'll actually pose to one another next week as we gather for baptism. We'll stand here and reflect on the movement of God's love and life through water throughout creation. And as we do that, we'll take time to pause and to make a commitment. And people that are being newly baptized will make a commitment to spend their days doing everything that they can to resist evil and injustice. And then all of us in our community will recommit. Because, see, baptism is not a one-time thing that happens to us. It is a way of life that God shapes us in. And so we'll make that commitment together and we'll pray then and hopefully not lose heart. For it is God who comes witnessing to us what it's like to pray ceaselessly and what it's like to not lose heart in the form of a widow who is herself made in the image of God, actively seeking God by going to the mat with our own fears, our own demons. As we hold on to God, who never lets us go, may that same God change us and shape us into the people God longs for us to be. Amen.